Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So let's just assume for a minute that the unthinkable ends up being thinkable, and Washington doesn't reach a deal to raise the debt ceiling by next Tuesday. Who's going to get paid? And who's going to be left out to dry? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. Today is Thursday, the 28th of July. It's great to have you here. I could start off with the latest back and forth on the debt ceiling, the different plans being voted on in Congress, the statements that there will eventually be a deal, but of course not the one that the other side wants. But since there are only 5 days left till D-Day, rather than hope for the best, it's probably best for all of us to start thinking about the other possibility.
If the government defaults, it's going to affect everybody. I'm retired now and I'm on a pension, but the state may decide it really can't afford to pay my pension anymore and discontinue it or something.
It's nothing but scary.
It's a high-stakes game that I think both sides realize that nobody wins if we do default.
Sort of reluctant to buy bonds right now also until we know what's going to happen with the debt ceiling and whatnot.
We were a little hesitant on investments right now. We were thinking of it, which, you know, we decided to wait and see.
We're digging a hole. We haven't done anything to prepare. I think we're just going to wait it out. It's going to be disastrous.
That was Bob Ingersoll, Carolyn McDermott, Lev Herrnson, and Jeannie Custis here in Los Angeles, and Chris Starrs and Sal Garner in Washington, D.C. So if Congress doesn't vote to raise the debt limit by next Tuesday, the U.S. government is going to be in a tough spot. The Treasury Department will have to decide what bills to pay and what bills not to pay. As you can imagine, that information is being kept pretty close to the vest. From Washington, here's Marketplace's David Gura.
The White House press secretary says the government writes about 80 million checks a month.
Veterans payments, Social Security payments, disability payments. They include the bills to contractors, small businesses, big businesses that do work with the government.
Jay Carney says that if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling,
choices then have to be made.
When George H.W. Bush was president, Jay Powell was undersecretary of the Treasury. Now he's at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Let's say that we decide to protect all of the safety net payment recipients.
Americans who get veterans benefits and Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and unemployment. Powell says the government should be able to cover those bills and pay interest on the debt, but not much more.
No money for the troops, no money for the companies that are supplying the troops in the field, even those in combat. There's also no money for the Justice Department.
And if the government decides to pay the troops, there wouldn't be enough to pay benefits. The Treasury Department's working on a plan, but according to Powell, it's not really up to them.
There is no role in our constitutional system for the executive branch to decide to prefer one form of spending over another.
That's up to the legislative branch. Rick Carnell was an assistant Treasury Secretary during the Clinton administration. He says Congress may allocate money for a certain program,
but in many cases it doesn't dictate how quickly the payment needs to be made.
So the Treasury Department could postpone that payment. It could decide to pay bills chronologically when they're due, starting on August 3rd with $23 billion of Social Security benefits. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, believe it or not, Washington is working on some other stuff right now. In fact, the Obama administration has just reached a deal with the automakers. It'll set the fuel efficiency standard at 54.5 miles per gallon on average by the year 2025. That's just 2 miles per gallon less than the standard President Obama initially wanted, but automakers thought would be too tough to meet. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports on what a difference a couple miles make.
When President Obama set 56 miles per gallon as the bar to reach, automakers cried, "Impossible! It'll ruin us!" Environmentalists said, "Reach higher! Go 60!" But Justin Hyde at the automotive website Jalopnik says, whatever numbers announced tomorrow, it won't mean what you think it does.
The fuel economy rule that comes out of the government is one of the most misleading numbers that any agency produces.
He says the government's not saying you'll be able to drive 54 miles on 1 gallon of gas, more like 40 miles. The fuel efficiency number gets hiked up with credits and loopholes for things like new LED headlights. Each company and each kind of car, Hummers to Leafs, get separate consideration.
And that's the behind-the-scenes fight that took so long to iron out.
Overall, starting in 2017, cars have to boost miles per gallon by at least 5% a year. Trucks and SUVs get graded on a lower curve. Hyde says that's seen as a win for Detroit.
The automakers who sell more cars than trucks, such as the Japanese automakers, are going to face a tougher time with some of this.
Automakers have to innovate pretty fast to meet the new standards. Scott Doggett at the car buying site Edmunds.com says that's expensive, with no guarantee for sales.
Instead of putting the burden on automakers to produce vehicles that consumers may not want because of the price point, it makes better sense to raise the cost of the fuel itself.
Yep, you heard him, a gas tax. He says that's a faster route to using less oil. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
There's been a lot of talk lately about Groupon, the website that emails you a coupon offer every day and lets you cash in if enough people sign up for the same deal. The company has been getting a lot of press about its meteoric rise and its plan to go public. But today, Groupon is in the news for a different reason. The Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into whether Groupon is trying to sell investors a deal that's too good to be true. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
At the height of the dot-com boom, companies that didn't actually make anything or have any profits found all kinds of creative ways to express their financial promise. Eyeballs, click-throughs, some statistic called mind share. Now it looks like Groupon may be trying to party like it's 1999, using a metric it invented called adjusted consolidated segment operating income.
Basically, I described it as the best possible way to view our business if you ignore all the things that make our business look terrible.
Rocky Agrawal is an analyst with Redesign Mobile. Using conventional accounting methods, Groupon lost $98 million in the first quarter of this year. But using its adjusted CSOI, the company made $82 million. This is important because investors need to understand Groupon's finances for its coming IPO, which is expected to value the company at $20 billion. Tomi Ogeron covers social media for Forbes.
A lot of people have had a problem with it because if you look at what they're saying, what it actually is revenues minus marketing expenses. Groupon is basically a marketing company, so to subtract marketing expenses is kind of ridiculous.
Groupon wouldn't comment for this story, but its rationale is that the expensive marketing for subscribers is an upfront, one-time cost, and all the other numbers are there for investors. It's just this one Groupon chooses to emphasize. Justin Fritz of Wall Street Daily says that reasoning could be a hard sell to the SEC.
I think there's a difference between emphasizing something and for it to be basically wrong.
Why would it be wrong? Fritz says while Groupon's subscriber base is growing, the proportion of people buying deals for spa treatments and Segway tours is declining. This suggests the company will be spending plenty on marketing for the foreseeable future. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
No deal today in Washington, but Wall Street's keeping its mouth shut this time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's no secret that the condo market isn't doing very well right now, and that's probably part of the reason why rent is rising in apartments around the country. People who would be buying condos are looking for landlords instead. Well, developers are taking notice, and you can see the evidence right in downtown Chicago, where a failed condo complex that's been sitting empty has a new lease on life. It's being turned into luxury apartments. From WBEZ in Chicago, Susie Ahn reports.
Take a cruise along the Chicago River and you'll see some of the city's most notable architectural gems, like the Merchandise Mart and the iconic Marina Towers. And then there's the 26-story building on West Wacker Drive. Really, it's just an unfinished skeleton of a building. It was supposed to be a 90-story luxury hotel and condo complex, but the Waterview Tower has new plans.
Luxury rental apartments, about 500 units.
That's Kurt Bailey, president of Related Midwest. His company recently bought the unfinished building. Why wouldn't Bailey just finish where the last condo developer left off?
Financing just frankly isn't available to build condos.
Add to that the perceived risk of buying in this market. Christopher Thornburg is with Beacon Economics. He says developers and investors are ready to cash in.
If you're sitting on a bunch of empty condos
And you're saying to yourself, what am I going to do with these to get some cash flow running? Clearly, you're going to look at the rental market.
Walter Maloney with the National Association of Realtors says rents are likely to rise about 3.5% this year. And that means building more apartment complexes.
We think that because of this underlying demand, mostly on the apartment rental side, construction this year is going to be up about 30%.
As for the potential apartment complex on Wacker Drive, Kurt Bailey expects to get top-of-the-market rents for these luxury units. In Chicago, I'm Susie Ahn for Marketplace.
Bad news, America, and I am not talking about the debt ceiling. A recent poll from the Arab American Institute in Washington finds our popularity among Arab nations is dropping again. In Egypt, for example, U.S. favorability was about 30% after President Obama was elected. It is 5% now. Now, this week, the same polling outfit had good news for the nation of Turkey. Its popularity in the Arab world is soaring. For the past few years, the country has pursued what it calls a zero problems policy with its neighbors, and it's been strengthening business ties with countries like Syria and Iraq. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
At the Beshler Flour Mill in eastern Turkey, workers drop 100-pound sacks of flour onto large spiral slides. Down they go. The sacks of flour end up in the backs of trucks that will take them to places like Iraq and Syria. In 2002, the company did about $1 million worth of foreign trade. Now its foreign trade is about $145 million. Beshler doesn't just sell flour. It sells sunflower oil and pasta, too. About half the company's business is with foreign clients, and neighboring countries account for most of that. Mesut Çakmak is a manager at Beshler. He says the Turkish government has been a big help.
The government's established good relations with neighboring countries. That makes it a lot easier for investors and businessmen to make deals with foreign firms and trade with them. That's the zero problem policy in action.
For example, arranging a trip to Syria used to be incredibly complicated. Now, thanks to visa-free travel between the two countries, he can be there in half an hour, and that's despite Syria's political situation. Gaziantep, the city where Beshler is based, is very close to both Iraq and Syria. It was part of the old Silk Road, so companies here have been doing business with the Middle East for centuries. But in recent years, Turkey's zero problems policies have helped turn Gaziantep into a modern boomtown.
Iraq and Syria and Saudi Arabia covers around 60% of our total trade.
Baran Çanar helps Gaziantep companies do business abroad through the city's Chamber of Commerce.
We are one of the biggest suppliers for those markets in textile, food, plastics, constructions.
Çanar says from what he hears, the unrest hasn't had much effect on companies yet.
We have companies who invested in Syria. They have factories in Aleppo. They have distributors in Aleppo, in Damascus. We didn't receive any complaints from them so far. I believe on TV sometimes can be a bit of exaggeration, sometimes.
He says some companies did have trouble getting paid by clients in places like Egypt and Libya, but that's mostly been resolved. There is an alternative view, though. Some here say Turkish companies are suffering because there's been less demand for goods and services from countries that are in turmoil. Nurhan Toj is chief economist at Ada Invest, which is a brokerage house in Istanbul. She says the Middle East is a big, diverse area.
Libya, for example, is one of the key countries for Turkey because of the major construction work in Libya region. So that will have more impact on Turkey than the other countries, for example, Egypt, because trade with Egypt is still very low.
And some countries haven't been changed by the Arab Spring. Turkish businesses working in Iraq, for example, are still doing well. And when individual businesses do well, so does Turkey's overall economy. It grew 11% in the first quarter of this year, which makes it the fastest growing economy in the world. At Beshler, the flour sacks are still sliding down the chutes. Mesut Çakmak, the manager, says he expects business will continue to flourish. He says, we're lucky. We sell food and people always need to eat. In Gaziantep, Turkey, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, if the wild stocks came back to their fullest capacity, they still wouldn't be able to feed the world. So I think this is the way of the future.
Why cod fishermen are turning into cod farmers. But first, let's do the numbers. A mixed bag on Wall Street today, but it was the fifth straight losing day for the Dow. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 62 points, 0.5% to finish at 12,240. The NASDAQ ticked up 1 point, a fraction of a percent, to end at 2766. The S&P 500 took off 4 points, a third of a percent, to close at 1,300 even. Boston Scientific pumped up 8.5%. The maker of heart devices raised its profit expectations, but it also announced plans to lay off as many as 1,400 workers. ExxonMobil drained 2.2%. It is the latest oil company with huge profits to fall short of Wall Street expectations. Sprint Nextel dialed down nearly 16%. Royal Caribbean sailed south by 12.5%. Bond prices rose because of the debt ceiling mess. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.95%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its advance estimate gross domestic product report for the second quarter. Like chainsaws? The Lumberjack World Championships get underway in Hayward, Wisconsin. And it's time to thank those guys who keep you networked, fight spam, and install stuff that makes your computer go. Friday is System Administrator Appreciation Day. And don't click on that suspicious link. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. There have been so many huge natural disasters in the last couple of years that the catastrophic 7.0 earthquake that devastated Haiti in January of last year seems a distant memory. It is not for Dr. Paul Farmer. He's the UN's Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti. He's also a professor at Harvard Medical School. And he's the author of a new book about the multi-billion dollar relief and recovery effort being carried out by the international community. The book is called Haiti After the Earthquake. Paul Farmer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, bring us up to date, first of all. You've recently been in Haiti. What's it like almost 20 months after the earthquake?
Well, there's some progress being made, both in terms of the acute relief, that is what we all did and what so many people did right after the earthquake, but also in terms of recovery. And of course, there are enormous problems, as you might imagine, especially around safe lodging for people displaced by the quake. And there's a cholera epidemic ongoing. We're still very much in recovery mode.
And of course, when it comes to paying for the recovery, you're relying on a lot of money that's coming in from the outside. I was surprised to read in your book that only 15% of the pledges that people made have actually been fulfilled.
It may be a little more than that now, but this was very instructive to me to see after international pledging conferences in general, not just the one after Haiti, the number of pledges that are actually kept often is less than 50%. And again, this is not just true of Haiti.
Is there any way for Haiti to go after that money? When a country says that they're going to give something, do they have any legal obligation to do so?
My guess is that the legal strategy is not going to work anywhere near as effectively as actually making sure the money is used wisely and implementing. One of the best things that they could do and we could all do is get these projects up and running and move them forward. That would probably speed up other groups keeping their promises.
When you respond to a disaster of this magnitude, you're not just rebuilding. You're sort of building a new Haiti. But how do you make sure that the Haitians have a stake in their own future if all of the decisions and all of the money is coming from the outside?
That is really the crux of the matter right now. You know, you need rules of the road. For example, how much of the money pledged actually goes to create local jobs, to make sure you're, whenever possible, favoring things like local procurement. If you look at food security, you know, their food aid is all imported food. There are local farmers and producers who would like a chance to participate in this kind of recovery and also food security. And it's definitely not yet a part of the rules of the road of development work.
Put on your professor hat for me for a second, Dr. Farmer. If you were teaching a course on international aid after a disaster, would Haiti be a good example or a bad example?
Haiti would be an example of a lot of goodwill and some good practice in humanitarian relief. I don't think it would be, to date, a good example of how to recover from a disaster of this magnitude. I'm going to give an example of cholera, since I'm a physician. We're working as hard as we can. We're saving a lot of lives. But we can't replace public water systems. And again, we can say, well, we can find several reasons it hasn't happened, but the fact that of the very substantial amounts of money being put into responding to cholera, too little of it has gone into public sanitation efforts, and that hasn't happened yet.
Dr. Paul Farmer, he is a professor at Harvard Medical School and the author of the new book, Haiti After the Earthquake. Paul Farmer, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
If you've eaten fish recently, chances are your dinner didn't spend his childhood swimming in the wild. He was probably raised in a tank or an open sea enclosure. That was the case for more than half of the fish we consumed last year, and that figure will probably rise. Starting next Monday, the state of Maryland will accept fish farming operations within the boundaries of oyster sanctuaries in the Chesapeake Bay. And now some fishermen in the state of Maine have decided to test the waters of the fish farming industry. Tom Porter from Maine Public Broadcasting has the story.
A fishing boat leaves the tiny village of Sorrento and heads out into the Atlantic Ocean. The men aboard, however, are not going fishing, but farming. They're students training to run their own fish farms at the nation's first ever Cod Academy. It's a program in Maine set up with the help of $183,000 in federal funding.
It's never been done before in America, and we're trying to see if it's a model that has some potential.
Sebastian Bell is director of the Maine Aquaculture Association and the project's lead instructor. He developed Cod Academy along with the University of Maine and a couple of private companies.
This is a very small program. We've only got enough money to run it for 1 year, trying to raise money to run it for some additional years.
It's based on successful programs in Norway and Japan to help underemployed commercial fishermen or ex-fishermen find new opportunities on the water. About a mile out to sea, eight circular pens emerge from the mist. They look like giant rubber inner tubes, covered over with netting to keep out seabirds. Each so-called cage can hold up to 50,000 cod. Bell says the strong Atlantic tides out here keep the fish healthy, even though they're penned in.
It's a native fish to Maine. The growing conditions in Maine are very good for cod, and it's a kind of a natural choice for us as a state.
Cod Academy students are taught every aspect of running a fish farm, how to maintain healthy stock, how to balance the books, and how to feed the fish. Students fling scoopfuls of specially formulated pellets into one of the giant pens. The surface of the water literally bubbles as thousands of cod come up to feed. Meanwhile, an underwater camera makes sure the fish are all being fed.
I'm not getting it spread over there very well.
One of the Academy's four students is Bill Thompson. He's a 59-year-old former commercial fisherman.
If the wild stocks came back to their fullest capacity, they still wouldn't be able to feed the world. So I think this is the way of the future.
Thompson is studying alongside his son, Bill Jr., who's been a working fisherman for most of his 39 years. But with a wife and four kids to support, he wants more job security. He and his dad plan to set up a family cod farming business after they graduate later this summer.
I look into the future, I can't see my kids set up in what I'm doing right now as far as, you know, lobstering and urchin, and I don't want to see them get a source that's depleting every year.
Not everyone, though, is happy. Jen Levin heads the Sustainable Seafood Program at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
There are a number of concerns about aquaculture.
She says some critics are worried that bunching fish together in a farm setting could spread disease and breed unhealthy stock. But, she says, the aquaculture industry is trying to address those concerns.
For example, the Global Aquaculture Alliance has developed best aquaculture practices that provide a certification for fish farms, making sure that it meets certain standards.
Levin says fish farms in Maine also use crop rotation type techniques to help counter the threat of disease. That means moving the fish to a new stretch of ocean every 3 years. From Sorrento, Maine, I'm Tom Porter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, turns out even the tooth fairy isn't safe from budget cuts. A survey from Visa, I'm not sure why they're doing surveys on the tooth fairy, but anyway, a survey from Visa found that last year, kids who put their lost teeth under the pillow got an average of $3 from the tooth fairy. This year, $2.60. Still more than I got. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 62 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ ticked up 1 point, a fraction of a percent. The S&P 500 took off 4 points, a third of a percent. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time back here, China's starting to think about the environment.
The pattern in China has been to develop land, not to protect it. This has meant most of the government-run national parks in China have limited funding.
Enter Chinese billionaires with millions to spare. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.